Hi everyone, and welcome to the Stage Left podcast with She Drew the Gun. Quick thank you to Jim Sharrock for fixing this up. We travelled up to Liverpool and spent a wild couple of nights at the Cavern, a highlight of which was singing in harmony to Ballad of John and Yoko with Louisa whilst Jim was playing the drums as Ringo at the Cavern, visiting Penny Lane and squeezing in a Father John Misty gig as well. So it was a wild weekend. And Louisa gave us a signed copy of her new record, which has been on loop ever since. So thank you to Louisa and Dawn for that. You can see photos of that on our Instagram page. Louisa is going to join us on our Stage Left Nights venture. So that's a 5-course meal cooked by an award-winning chef in our lounge in Vauxhall in London, where Louisa will be playing a live intimate acoustic set for just 7 people. That's all the people that's going to be in the room. Who the fuck wouldn't want to come to that, right? So it's an amazing 5-course meal cooked by an award-winning chef and a live performance from Louisa in such an intimate setting. Everyone has to bring a vinyl record, which is the background music during the meal. Another Stage Left events we've had so far have been with John Woff of the 1975 and Goldheart Assembly, and we've got the likes of James Walsh of Star Sailor, Jess Greenfield of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, Romeo of the Magic Numbers, and Portishead and Radiohead's live drummer Clive Deamer are also coming up. So do get in touch with us. You can do that by emailing stageleftnights@gmail.com for details. And you can follow us online, search a Stage Left podcast or Stage Left Nights on Instagram to secure a seat, as Louisa's tickets are obviously going to be gold dust because there's only 7 of them. So the email is stageleftnights@gmail.com. We're also starting live nights at the Groucho Club in Soho. November the 27th is with Ian Brody of the Lightning Seeds. Get in touch for details around that. And She Drew the Gun also going to be doing one of these events in future, so do get in touch. Okay, thank you to Alex Soykins for the website, Andy Phelan and congratulations on his new baby River. Awesome name there, by the way, Andy. And Wolfie for editing this. Hope you enjoy it. Here we go. This is Louisa from She Drew the Gun. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide pre-educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the writing, recording and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, Patti Smith, The Beatles, Radiohead, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, Bob Dylan, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. On a very, very special episode today, being recorded on Penny Lane no less, we have a guest who is a contemporary voice in an uncertain time, a truly gifted young songwriter, a poet armed with a pen, whose new album Revolution of Mind has just come out, Louisa from She Drew the Gun. Today we'll be taking a deep dive into the songwriting processes behind the modern anthem poem, cited by Steve Lamacq as his single of 2016, and how this process has evolved to the new material, which includes single Resistor and genuinely the best fucking chorus you've possibly never heard, Something for the Pain. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Louisa from She Drew the Gun. Thanks for joining us today, Louisa. How's it going?
It's good, yeah. Nice to be here.
Good stuff. So a few years ago in an interview, you were asked your dream festival lineup, and you answered by saying the Coral would headline.
Did I?
Yeah, right. So I guess the last few weeks must have been fun because you've just come back off a tour of supporting the Coral, is that right?
Yeah, it's been really cool. They're just an amazing band, so yeah, they've been like obviously headlining every night, and we've been like going on before them, and I just love the Coral's music, and James, obviously I've worked with James for a while, and they're all really nice lads.
And when you're going on a tour and you're supporting, as opposed to kind of doing your own shows, how does it differ to your approach about what you're trying to achieve out of it?
It is like really different because it's like,
really? Why?
Yeah, I think so, because it's like, it's not your crowd, it's like if you're doing headline tours, then people are basically there to see you, so you do like your thing completely, and then when you're doing a support tour, you're like, it's someone else's crowd, you've got to like win them over, you've got to like cut it down to like your best bits kind of thing. And
how do you win them over?
I think you just gotta like just play good tunes, and I think especially Coral fans are gonna like good tunes, so you just have to go play your best stuff, get the set get the set list in the right order.
So I guess like as you're playing, more and more fans are filtering in. So do you like think, oh, well, we'll keep the really big stomping ones that we know people are most going to like towards the end?
A support band kind of trick. It's like, well, not a trick, but you do sometimes think just like keep the best ones till the end because it does filter in. But for this tour, actually, it was like quite full, and the Cuckfast Kings were playing before us as well. Like two supports.
Oh,
so
nice.
We actually had like a really good audience there when we were playing the whole time. So, we just kind of like had our little half an hour set sorted and that was it.
And the new album, absolutely loving it. What was the blueprint for the record from your perspective? What did you, I don't know if you had pre-production meetings or anything like that, but what did you particularly want to achieve or do differently on this record compared to the last?
I think I just wanted to, it kind of happened like tune by tune. It wasn't like I just went and wrote like an album. It was like tune by tune over like a period of time. And I think from the difference from like writing the first album was like, I would just sit there with a guitar and kind of write whatever came into my head. And I was like, well, I'll just pick a little chord pattern or a little finger picking thing. And I'll just write the tune over that. And then this time it was more like, what do I want the finished thing to sound like? It was like I already had that in the kind of corner of my mind. So, like, I was like, I want a tune that sounds like this, I want a tune that sounds like that. So it was more like thinking about the finished product. And with the first album, it was just kind of like more just thinking about whatever was going through my mind at the time. I wasn't like thinking about how it would finish.
And how different does the finished product sound to what was in your head when you were kind of, visualising it, if you like?
Yeah, it's obviously hard to imagine what the whole thing's going to be like when it comes out, when all the production's done and everything. But with this one, we did demos of all the tunes, so I had a bit more of an idea of what it would sound like.
Ah.
Whereas with the first one, it was no demos or anything, it was just me going into the studio with my guitar, and then we'd like put the guitar down, put the vocals down, and then we'd just like build the track from that. And then with this one, it was like me and Jack from the band had worked on all the demos at home in my garage, and we started sending them over, and then they all collected into enough for an album, and then we went into the studio and did it. And then in the studio, everything got heightened, everything got like a little bit better, but we kind of like knew an idea of what they'd be like.
And I've always wanted this as a songwriter. I've written lots of songs myself, but I've never been in a position where I'd be writing a song and having a good idea that is probably going to be listened to by quite a lot of people. So I'm guessing that's a different thing that you're having to adapt to from the first record, because when you wrote the first record, I guess as a new artist, you didn't really know if it was going to be picked up, and it was picked up and it was great. So how does your approach get impacted by the realization that it's quite likely people will listen to this? You know that already. How do you keep kind of yourself loose and creative in that situation and not let that thought kind of creep in and change your creative processes?
Yeah, I suppose that's why they call it the tricky second album, because you have got like a little bit of an audience no matter how big it is. But I think you've just got to, like, if you think you're doing something better than it was before, then you don't really let that kind of worry you, because you're progressing, you're doing something a bit different, a bit better than, well, you can, I thought it was a bit better what the way that it was doing it and stuff like that. So I think you got to kind of not let that pressure. I think that pressure is almost more there before you even start writing it. I think once you start going with it, then you kind of lose that. I think it's just before that, before you start writing it, you kind of have this little idea in the back of your head, like, that you're never going to be able to write a song again or something. Like, you're kind of something saying, oh, what are you going to do? It's a completely blank page. But then once you start, it's like writing anything. Once you've actually start putting stuff on the page, then it all comes together.
Because it sounds like the record just doesn't feel like you were chained by that at all. Like, it feels really like there's no restriction in the record. It doesn't sound like it's something that was in the back of your mind, or you were trying to second guess what audiences might want or anything. It's just, you've kind of really nailed that. Tell us about the feedback you've got so far that surprised you about certain tracks. So, like, you probably had a good idea what the songs that people may or may not like. Have you had kind of any feedback that people particularly like particular songs or anything that's kind of surprised you, that you it was a different vantage point from before?
Well, I think that it's the feedback has like just been trickling in from different places, and I was surprised, like, when we went to do the Six Music session, Lamac was like, or Steve Lamac was just like saying how much he loved it and that, and I was kind of like, I was taken aback by how much he loved it, because I know he likes us, I know he liked the first album, but he surprised me how much he was like saying how much he liked it. And then, I don't know, we've had a couple of really nice reviews. A lot of people have been saying individual tracks to me that they like. Quite a few people are enjoying Paradise, and someone said Between the Stars is the best thing we've ever done, and, you know, like, yeah, the individual tracks are all getting a lot of love. And then and people are like, oh, Human made me cry. And
it's the last track, right?
So, like, it's nice when the individual tracks get good feedback.
But you can't see if it shines till the cutting is done. If the task takes you right back to where you've gone. Now some things are just meant for you.
And the song Resistor, which is obviously a cracking tune. It's a bit of a call to arms, and I really like the fact that your use of the reprise on this. So, like, it's one of the most effective uses I've seen of this. So you kind of do it as the opening track, and then it's kind of just before the album closes again. But were they two completely different tracks that you thought, okay, actually I can merge these as a reprise, or was the later part towards the end of the album, was that kind of a leftover part of the first song? Do you know what I mean? What was the relationship between those two?
Yeah, that was exactly it. Like it was like one big song, but it was just like too big. Like I tried to put it all into Resistor, and then I sent that over as the tune. I sent it to James, and I was like, "What do you think about this?" And he was like, "It's just too long," and he was like, "You need to cut this, cut that," and he was like, "I was like, no, I can't do that." And then ended up like cutting it as much as like I could, and then there was still just loads left over, so I was like, I'll just do another tune out of it, and just do a mad beat, and we'll put it out. And I was like, reprise, no one ever does a reprise. So I was like, if the Beatles, like, you know, the Beatles, if you can copy off a Beatles idea, then it's pretty cool. Positively utopian. Banks, every carer, the troubled and the crazed, to every colour blend and shade, because racism is man-made, racism is learned, and we have to unlearn it and understand how our institutions.
Also, on the subject of the Beatles, is that, you know, they were so prolific and released material like over and over again, just like they did so much in such a short period of time, and kind of the coal for a while were just like churning out stuff, really, like one thing after another. Have you been put under pressure by anybody to like release anything soon, or do like two records in a year, or do a record every 6 months or anything like that, or is it just down to you to write the best songs in a time period you can and then you just go with it?
It was like with this record, it was like, right, you do need to kind of do this now kind of thing, or like, you know, you're gonna have to have it by then. So it was like there was a deadline to work to, and I was like, okay, just start sending a couple over. And I think like the last couple of tunes were in like the week before the album.
Really?
Yeah, so it was like when you've got like a big assignment to do or something, and you're like you're like you're working on it for a while, but then you do like put the heat on for the last, like working up to the last bit.
Wow.
Do you think
that brought the best out of you, or would you look those last two tracks, you don't have to name it, but are they like ones that like were particular like, favourites of yours, or were they ones that you think, oh, I could have spent a bit more time on them? Like, did that help having that deadline or
I think it helped, yeah. I don't know. It's like good to like it's nice to have all these ideas in your head, and you know, and I kind of like work like that. I've got like a few ideas cooking, and got a few like documents open on me Mac, and I'm just like adding stuff to them, and then, you know, it would probably just take me too long to come out with it if someone didn't say like you need to do something there now. So it was good to have a deadline. And the reprise was, I think the reprise was the last tune, and it was like, I think I can't remember if like I decided about what using that leftover bit to do a reprise. I think that might have been like a last minute decision, but yeah.
It's really effective. One thing I was like particularly interested in, you've got a very, very distinctive vocal sound on both records, and given they've kind of recorded through like what, 4 years apart, maybe 3 or 4 years apart, like what do you like, were you using the same mics, or do you like, because you have this really nice thing where it's, I'm guessing that it clips a little bit on the, you know, I can imagine it goes into the red a little bit with your vocal, and it sounds fucking so good. It's like, it's a little tiny bit distortion or something like that. Is that, I mean, don't have to give you secrets away, but is it particularly mics you use, or do you record them dry? Are you hearing that when you're recording it, or is that put on post-production? How does that work?
It's post-production, yeah. I'm not hearing that when I'm singing it. I do ask for like a little bit of something, so that it's not singing completely dry, because it does help a bit. But yeah, I have a bit of distortion on, and I have like some slap back, and I'm not even sure completely what they are, but I know like when we were doing the demos, I was like messing with GarageBand. That's the only thing I can use.
Yeah.
But we'd in GarageBand, we'd put the effects on that we wanted, which was mostly slap back and a bit of distortion, and then, you know, in the studio, they know what they're doing, obviously, and they'll like put the best versions of it all on.
So tell us, what's the setup in the studio? So is James producer?
Yeah.
And then you've got engineers working with him, I'm guessing, yeah, as well. So how does that work? You know, you said you did some demos. Talk us through a day in the studio with James. What's his unique production qualities, if you like, yeah, to get the best performance out of you?
Yeah. Well, demos is like what I just did at home, me and Jack did.
Yeah.
And then we'd send them over. We'd work on them to get them as good as we could, and then send them over, and then like get the nod on whether the tune was good enough to be in the album, kind of thing. And then we'd, obviously, in the studio, it was kind of done in two different sessions. Like, we did, I can't remember the date actually, but early on we went in and recorded, actually, the first one that we did was Revolution of Mind. That was the album track. Did that quite a while before everything else, because we were thinking about just doing a single before anything else was written on the album. So we went and recorded that, but we didn't end up putting that out as a single. But that was just like done in one day. That didn't have a demo. That was just done in one day with me, James, and Richard Parstreet. And then we went and did another batch. We did Wolf and Bird, Dopamine, and another tune, can't remember right now. But we did like three tunes. That was with James and Chris
in
Taylor.
A day. Three in a
in
day,
2 days.
In 2 days, right.
2 days, yeah. So that was like the whole thing. And then I can't remember what the question was.
So what's it, what is unique production stuff? So
oh, yeah. What does James bring
to
the...
What's his...
So we'll go in, we'll put the... I mean, the drums have always been the last thing that we've done on both records. So
really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
they're drumming to a click?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. That's unusual.
Yeah. So we always, like with the first album, like obviously we didn't have any demos, just went in, me on the guitar, we come up with a click that went with it, and then we just, so that would be the first thing, was down the vocals, the guitar and the click, and then everything would be built up from that. And then with this album, We already knew what the beats were kind of going to be like, because I'd made the demos.
Right, okay.
So we just went in, took the beats from the demos,
gotcha,
put them into the system, and then made a similar clip. So that was the foundation to start from. So then we just do the guitars, the bass, just one by one, put all the things down. And James is just really good at going, yeah, that's good, that... you know, we should change that a bit, and it's just got like really good ears for putting the whole thing together.
And is there anything that he particularly has ever done that's tried to get a particularly good performance out of you vocally? Like, do you have to get yourself, or do you do that yourself? Do you get yourself into a, you know, headspace beforehand, or is it just a case of going in there and just turning it on straight away?
I think it's just, I think we have, like, for one time on the first album, we were doing a tune that was like, yeah, turn all the lights down low and like get a nice atmosphere in the room, because it like kind of fitted with the tune. I think it might have been like If You Could See or something, and it was like, you know, that's make a nice atmosphere. But apart from that, it's pretty much just like just go in and record the vocals, do a few takes, and most of the time anyway.
So there's a particular detail in your kind of writing performance that I really like, and that is that you don't find the necessity always to find like rhyming couplets or fill in lines to the end of the, like, the fourth beat of the bar if you have done the previous one. And so you just kind of get across that you're basically always saying the words that you want to say when you see so many people try and find a word that rhymes. Do you know what I mean? Like just to kind of get that across. So is there anyone you've ever kind of noticed do that? And is that something that you deliberately do, that you don't feel kind of chained into getting everything to rhyme on every single line and compromising what it is you actually want to say?
I don't know if I've noticed that. I think it's just like kind of a natural thing that you feel like, oh, that will work or that won't. I don't know whether that's in, is that in more like in spoken wordy bits or
no,
just in general?
Just generally. So it's really nice that you don't always, I'm trying to think of an example now, but it's just really nice how you don't always, like, so a bad, like, I do like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, but a bad kind of example of, like, the Red Hot Chili Peppers sometimes, where they feel like they have to kind of get everything to be the same syllables, yeah, the same couplets, like, on the beat every single time, and you're quite happy to kind of drift ahead and slightly behind it and just yeah, say what I want to say. It's like, it sounds so confident, it's like, this is what I want to say, I'm not going to be, oh, the right processes here would be to make everything exactly rhyme. It's just like, it's just a real charm, and I wonder if that's a deliberate thing that you decided to do, or if it's something
it
you picked up from someone else.
I don't know if I picked it up. I don't know where I picked it up from. I think it's just like what I like. So it's just like personal preference. Like, do I think that sounds nice there, or do I think that fits? And if it feels right, then it's okay.
Particular song on the album that I'm just absolutely fucking loving, which is Something for the Pain.
Mm-hmm.
You're releasing that single?
Yeah, that's the next single, yeah.
Good fucking choice. That is such a big tune. Tell us about writing that specifically, perhaps what it's about, yeah, what you remember writing, you know, the chords. What's the first memory of writing that particular song?
Yeah, the first memory of writing that tune is the chords, yeah. I was just going from the chords.
Verses?
The verses, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the verses, about the verse first, and then worked out what the chorus should be after that. But yeah, just playing around with those chords for the verses and what the melody would be like. And then putting the words to it was like working out what was going to be about. And it's like a science fiction tune. So it's like, it's based in the future at the point when the refugee crisis has got so big, and like basically everyone's almost a refugee because it's so bad, and like it's at the point where mankind decides to like put people ahead of profit and treat everyone as like a citizen of the earth. So it's like a utopia.
Mm.
It's like a utopian song. So it's like Smiled Upon a Stranger in a Blue Marble Basement is that stranger is like a refugee from the future, and it's like having a conversation with them at the point where the world has turned to a better place.
And where did that come from? It's a great concept. You should be writing Black Mirror episodes, like, yeah. Get in touch with Charlie Brown.
I kind of like, I like science fiction, and I like to kind of use it in tunes sometimes, just to like think about like possible worlds, and you know, how things could turn out is like interesting to me. So and like I think as a writer it's like an interesting like thing to play with that makes you come out with lyrics that are a bit different. So I was just made it so I like to get like the means of production into like a lyric of like a 60s sounding tune. Like just like to throw those kind of concepts in, and it was just cool.
And the chorus, you say that, did that come directly from like
the
last
the chorus,
bit?
The chorus came from this poetry book that someone gave me when we played a gig in Glasgow. Someone called C.C. Smith gave me a poetry book of her poems, and I read it, and one of them was like, it said, may you always have walls for the wind, roofs for the rain, buy another drink for the pain or something.
Right.
Like that. So I kind of nicked it. Well, I did nick it. And then And then I spoke to her afterwards and I was like, yeah, I kind of nicked your poem for my tune. And she was like, I'm really glad you did, but it's not man. It's like an old like Celtic saying.
Oh,
so
right.
It's like an old like Irish or Celtic saying, something right. to do with that. Like it's similar.
Big tune, it's a great choice as a single, and you just kind of called out Paradise as well, which is obviously another one. Is that gonna be, that's got to be a single,
yeah, that's going to be another one, yeah.
Is it right? Okay. yeah, so tell us what you remember about writing that and what that's about.
Well, that one was a co-write with me and James, so we just went in to the studio for a day and with Rich Turvey and with just the aim of writing a new tune. I was like, what are we doing? And we were just like, oh, just going to write a new tune. And I was like, oh my God, okay. On the spot. But yeah, so we did that. And I already had some like kind of rough idea of lyrics for it. And the idea of it is a bit like, it's a bit like a grotesque advertisement for today. It's like a kind of 50s advert for where we are today. Like, you know, a bit fucked. A bit of a fucked up 50s advert for capitalism, and you know, it's like a capitalist paradise that we're living in, so
yeah. And that particular song, so you said you had to write that in a songwriting session that you weren't even expecting. It was kind of, we've got to write it today, or?
Yeah, I didn't know, I knew we were going to do the session, but I didn't exactly know exactly what we were going to do. And then I was like, I just text James and said, what are we actually doing on Monday or whenever it was? And he was like, oh, I'm just going to do a new tune. So I was like, okay.
There you go. As soon as you put time constraints on stuff, all your best stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. There you go. Something to learn from that.
Yeah.
Cool. So I was going to ask you about how these songs are translating to live, and you're actually probably out of like 55, 60 episodes, the only guest I've had on here who I've not seen perform live, but I have a very good excuse as to why that's happened. Because last year at Glastonbury, I was working at Glastonbury, running this tent for a charity, and what we did is I was coordinating all the different shifts and rotas, and everybody who wanted to see an artist who was supposed to do a rota was kind of given this golden pass to say, look, you can go off and see whoever you wanted. The one I chose was to see you, right?
Aww.
So I finished my little shift, and I'd like 5 minutes to get to your stage. Literally rushed to the stage, got there, and there's a band like midway through their set, and I thought, this is weird, like, they don't overrun at Glastonbury very much. I was like, what's going on here? Gave it a few minutes, they're still starting up a new tune. I was like, what the fuck? Checked my phone, and I was on the wrong stage, basically. I realised you were over the other side of the festival. And for anyone who's not been to Glastonbury is fucking enormous. It's such a huge site. So I decided to do something I don't do very often at festivals, and decided to run. Start running towards where your stage is, so I could capture some of it on my break. And went over this mound, slipped over, and cracked my ankle, right?
Uh-huh.
And it was loud enough that I could actually hear this crack, right?
Oh, no.
And I got up, and I was like, I genuinely thought I'd broken something. I thought, I can't be stretched out of Glastonbury, this can't be happening. So I stood up, put weight on it, and it hurt a lot, but I thought, I've not broken my ankle, right? I looked down, and it immediately already, like, massively swollen up. But I thought, well, I might as well just carry on making my way there, because I've got nothing better to do. And on the way, between where I was and your stage was the healing fields.
Yes.
So I walked through, and I was just like, I should really kind of get this looked at by someone. And so this like little like really nice but like kind of like wizard lady comes in and sees my ankle and says, no, you really need, we can help you with that, right? And so she sits me down, and I'm like thinking I'll just quickly check it and go. And she goes, oh well, no, you know. And she said, if you could contribute £10, and I was like, yeah, that's fine. And then she starts going out to the back and like gets this big bucket and puts my leg in this bucket and fills up water, and then comes back with all this random stuff that she's putting in that's like so hippie. It's like at one point, like it was like apricot or something like that. Yeah, right. And I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, like, please hurry up. Like, I'll just, it doesn't matter. And then I was like, I resigned myself to the fact I wasn't going to see you. And then it was quite a windy day, and I genuinely could hear Where Andy and You Begin in the distance while I looked down with this fucking apricot and my leg in this bucket of water. And so I didn't get a chance to see you at Glastonbury, and then I was going to come see you last Thursday when you supported the Coral, but I bought tickets for my dad to see his favourite band ever, most dad band ever, ELO. And I took, got the tickets, and I've got to take him there, the best night of his life. So I've actually genuinely not seen you live, which I will rectify very soon. Yeah. My ankle is now fine. But the question I've got for you, therefore, is, you know, how do your songs translate live? What are the challenges from, even from the first record, to playing them live? What are the challenges on kind of recreating them or different, doing different versions?
Yeah, the challenges, like, recreating it, yeah, that's the whole thing, because you've gone in the studio, you've made all these sounds, and then you're like, well, how do we do that? So you've got to, like, you know, get the keyboard, get the main stage, get working on trying to like sculpt the sounds to be the same as what they were. And not exactly the same, because you're never gonna get exactly the same, and you don't necessarily want it to be exactly the same. But yeah, I think the main challenge is the keyboard sounds, like just getting all the stuff that's gone in, because there's so many layers that end up going on the album. So you've just got to, like, you've got like so many keys, and you're like, so many patches of different sounds, and you're just like, so let's start working on this, like, let's get this together. Apart from that, I don't know, I think live is like a bit of a different, it's got a bit more energy live, so you've got to kind of, I don't know, like, you just gotta work out how the best way to perform it, the best way to get it across. Do I want to put my guitar down and just get on the mic for a bit? And, you know, it's always a challenge just trying to work out how to keep getting better, because that's what you want to do. Like, yeah, people have been to see you before, and you want to make sure the next time that they see you, you've gone to a different level. You just want to, you've just got to always got to keep improving. So I think, mixing it up, getting the lyrics across.
You put drums on Poem now, haven't you, live, is that right? Towards the end of the song. What was the decision behind that?
I think it was just like, let's just do it, because it's like, let's just build it up a bit and, you know, add something else to it for the end bit. Why not? It was just an idea, because you get in the rehearsal room and people come up with ideas for stuff, and that was just an idea. We tried it. We did a military beat to it, but now we've started doing like a boom, 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 boom beat. I shouldn't be like telling everyone, because it's not a surprise then when it's live.
But it sounds great. So yeah,
we've been like making it, I don't know, it just like gets people going a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the new stuff's coming across live really well, which sounds great. Tell us about, so Jim Sharrock is playing drums with you at the moment.
Yeah.
Great drummer. So he's one of the disciples of Chris Sharrock, a legendary drummer who, for those who aren't aware, played with Lars. He played on There She Goes, which is great. He's played in Oasis. He's Noel Gallagher's current drummer. He played Robbie Williams, loads and loads of people. And he's, he taught the drums to Jim, his nephew. He now plays with Lion Seeds, plays with Yourself, and does loads of cool stuff. What's his qualities as a drummer?
He's a really great drummer. He knows what he's doing. He's like, he's got loads of energy. He just brings it to like the live environment. And he's just like a really nice guy, and I don't know, he makes you feel quite chilled out as well, which is really cool.
That's cool. He's a good guy. And, I just mentioned the Lightning Seeds. In the previous interview, you said that one of your favourite albums growing up was Jollification.
Yeah, it was, yeah. I literally remember, like...
The Strawberry.
Yeah, I remember sitting there with the Strawberry, like the CD, and playing it, like, in my nan's house. Just remember, like, listening to it, and I think, like, at that time, probably knew all the words to it or something, but, yeah, it was, like... I just you know, some albums you just like literally remember where you were and you were like listening to it.
I mean, it's you know, that's obviously quite a while ago, but like, do you think there's any qualities from, you know, that experience and that music that fed its way into the way you approach writing at all?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's like a kind of, there's like a popness to Liverpool writing, which is like, you know, goes way back. There's like, there's some kind of like pop quality, but it's not quite, you know, it's not like rubbish like nowadays. I'm not saying all pop's rubbish, but you know, it's not like pop the way that you'd think. It's like, it's just the traditional kind of verses and choruses, and like something about putting them together. There's something like, something that Liverpool writers seem to do that connects that.
What is that? It's so, like...
Do you know what I mean?
Being in Liverpool for, like, one day, I was just like, this is such a small place for so many amazing musicians to have kind of come from. What is the source of that? Why is that? It's incredible.
I think, like, I don't know, it must be, like, going back, it must have been because it was, like, a doc, like, kind of, like, because there was a lot of influences coming in from around the world into a port, do you know what I mean?
Right.
I think going back, if you go way back, that's probably, like, the root of it, but I guess it's just, I don't know, like, yeah, there's like a kind of good pop tradition that goes all the way back to like the Beatles, and they kind of gave the blueprint of how to do it, didn't they, as well?
Certainly did. And I went to the Cavern last night, and it was just, obviously we're going to go again, you know, tonight, and it's just, you know, this city kind of bleeds great music. It's just, there's so many bands, and it's just, you know, to go to the Cavern last night and see, you know, it was a Friday night, and there was like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in there, just so passionate about music, like music geeks as well. Do you know what I mean? It's really nice to see.
Yeah, it's like everyone's in a band or something. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, music's like, pretty much in the water or something.
Now, a lot of your songs are kind of a bit of a call to arms, and in one of the lyrics I picked up on this record is that you said this world needs to change, which I think most of us would agree with.
Mm-hmm.
What is that change for you, and what are the resistant points you're encountering towards the change you refer to?
That's a good question. I think it's like, well, we need to change in so many ways. I just feel like if we carry on, if things carry on the way they are, then, you know, we're not going to survive. The Earth's not going to survive. We're not going to survive as a species. I mean, capitalism is going to just carry on eating up the world and all the resources, and just to make sure that a few people... well, not just a few, but, you know, there's a small elite that are well better off than everyone else. And if we carry on the way that we're going, it's going to mean destruction of our civilization and the world. I mean, that's what I think, it's that bad. Like, so I just think the change, but it's like what the whole album is saying as well, is like the change needs to come in people's minds, really. It's like, there's like this saying from Rosa Luxemburg, this old like socialist revolutionary from the past. She was like, the strike doesn't cause the revolution causes the strike. It's like, once enough people's minds are switched onto the right way of knowing that things do need to change, then that's when the change will come. So it's like, people need to, I think, you know, we're blinded by media, by propaganda, by the way things are. Like, I think we're just carrying on part of the machinery. Things need to change so badly. The changes are so big that it's hard to like envision how they'd actually be able to happen. But I think if enough people want it, then it'll change.
And the way to do that is to raise awareness around it, which is what you're doing with your music. I think that's really, really important. I do this course in around how to support people through change, and it's really interesting. There's this model called ADCAR. I don't know if you ever heard it, but it's like a 5-stage model.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps pinpoint resistance to change. So people can be resistant to change, but actually be on board with some of the ideas. Mm-hmm. So what it does, so the A stands for awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of an example, or listeners right now, think of an example when someone's been resistant to change, whatever it might be. And this has helped people, our friends who went through like divorces and stuff like that, and accepting that, or going through someone who worked in an office and was scared of a new computer system coming in. You know, it's applicable to all situations, as are some of the changes we're talking about here. And so the first point was awareness. So are you resistant to that? Or was that person resistant to the change because it caught them unaware? It shocked them. Like, is something that's new that's come to them? It's the awareness. Well, no, if you knew already that this is something on the horizon, it might be D, which is the desire. Mm. Have you created the circumstances for someone to have the desire to change? And sometimes you have circumstances where you go, yeah, I've got the awareness, I've got the desire. Mm. It's the K, which is the fall down, which is people don't have the knowledge how to do it.
Yeah.
And the remaining parts of it are A and R, which is do you have the ability, i.e. the resources to be able to change?
Yeah.
And the R comes later, which is reinforcement, which is once you've implemented the change, that you reinforce that this is a good thing and that we don't go back to the old world. And there's lots of ways that people have done that in the past. And I think with what you're doing is you're really, really creating the A around it, you're creating the awareness.
Yeah.
But what we somehow need to do, I mean, if you take some of the some of the subjects you're talking about, is create the motivational reason for someone to want to change so massively when they have these like ingrained beliefs.
Mm.
And that's really, really hard. Got any ideas?
I think like the poet or the musician's kind of job is not to have all the answers to how we're going to make all the change. I think it's more like to ask the questions or to, get people thinking. And like that's one step in it. That's all you can do, really.
I agree with that. You said about the, there's one line you've put in this record about some views need to be unlearned. I think when you talk about it, you have to unlearn it. What does that look like? What does unlearning look like?
I think, yeah, for me, well, that was the question, the thing in that was like, I think, yeah, it's like I was saying about the machinery, like, you've been taught one way your whole life, and sometimes you have to question that and, like, kind of unlearn the things that you've been taught or the way that you've learned to do something. And I think, yeah, that was in the reprise, and that was about racism being learned, and we have to like take a step back and look at how our institutions are racist, and they do like keep perpetuating that problem, and the way things are now is because of a load of different reasons, but you have to try and think of how did we get to where we are and why we are privileged and who's suffered from that. And I mean, it's like people think like the British Empire and ruling the world and colonising everywhere is something to be proud of. And it's like, we need to like...
Fucking Union.
We need to unlearn that, do you know what I mean?
Unlearn it. Yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah. You're a mother, and I wondered if you ever think, when you're writing about, like, what do you think about your child listening to your music in future? Does that ever come into your mind that, one day, your child's going to listen to your music and reflect back on what, their mum was trying to say?
Mm. He's, like, my biggest fan, so...
Oh, nice.
He knows all the songs and all the words, so he's, like, there anyway, like, he's there at, like, right now, he's, like... He's along for the journey, and whenever I can bring him to like a festival or bring him to help, he's like the little roadie and stuff. Nice. So like he is part of the journey anyway. So yeah, I think that's it. He's part of it now anyway. So I think hopefully when he's older, he'll still like it. But yeah, he's a massive hip hop fan. So he's into like Kendrick Lamar, and he's like showing me new rappers and things like that, so that's cool. But he likes really good music, and then he still likes She Drew the Gun as well, so I'm just hoping that he'll carry on with that. And he won't be like, no mum, that's not my bag now.
And reflecting back, what's your memories of the first song you wrote? What was it called? What was it about? And what chord progression did you rip off?
The first actual full song I wrote, I mean, I did try and write when I was younger. I did actually have a few little bits, but the first proper song that I wrote was What Will You Do, which was on the first album.
Really?
Yeah.
Fuck.
That was like...
Nice start.
That was like the first, like, when I was like, okay, I've wrote a song and I'm like, Yeah, that's sound. I mean, I must have wrote songs like, I see it as like two separate things. Like I did play guitar and did stuff when I was like really young, and then I had this like gap in between and I didn't really do anything, and then I picked it up again like in my late 20s, and that's when I wrote What Will You Do, and I like wrote this full song and I was like, actually, yeah, that's not that bad, and that's what like kind of like gave me the kind of little bit of hope that I'd carry on writing and could do something. Like, I don't know, just write a few more tunes. That was all I wanted at that time. I just wrote this tune, I was like, that's all right. And I played it to a few people and they were like, yeah. And then, yeah, that ended up going on the first album.
Wow, nice start. I know that you went to uni a bit later as a mature student, is exactly what I did actually. And one of the reasons the podcast exists, as kind of I mentioned at the beginning, is that with the tuition fees going skyrocketing and the fact the arts funding is kind of been cut out, I do fear there's a risk that people who might have had exposure to that kind of environment just won't get the opportunity for that kind of thing anymore. Mm. And I wonder, so I think you did a degree in psychology, is that right?
I did, yeah.
So what are the transferable skills you think you might have learned from doing a degree, regardless of the subject,
mm-hmm.
that has helped you as a songwriter or musician or working in the music industry? What did you learn in that process that helped you?
I think like the first thing is probably writing an essay, because it like makes you go, what are all these things? I've got to have a start, a middle and an end. I've got to do it by the deadline. I've got to, you know, I'm going to have to like take all this knowledge about a few things and put it into one thing. And it's a little bit like writing a song in a way.
Mm.
And it's got a kind of, like, for me as well, a song has got to make sense, like, the way that an essay does. It's got to say something, it's got to be complete, you know what I mean? So I think essay writing, and I did enjoy essay writing, even though, like, I was probably, like, a bit late handing them in most of the time. But, I don't know if I actually enjoyed it, but I enjoyed the thing when you finished it and you've done it, you know what I mean? And then, so I think that's the number one transferable skill. But then also, it was just reading, like,
research skills.
Yeah, research skills, yeah, just enjoying reading about new ideas and what like people have said before, and you know, a bit of history, and I don't know, just kind of opened your eyes to stuff that you wouldn't come across on a day-to-day basis just watching telly or listening to the radio, do you know what I mean?
Anything else? What else was transferable? There's a lot that you would have learned in that time, I'm guessing. Anything else that was useful?
I think it's mostly like the essay and the...
It's the structuring of song. Do you structure your song similarly, kind of making a point in each song? Are you trying to answer a question?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Or ask a question. And then it's like, it's that whole... It's like you've got a boundary to work in.
Mm.
And you've got that with a tune as well. I like the boundary of a 3 or 4 minute tune to get an idea across, or to get, or to, you know, ask a question of someone, or to, you can just do something a bit mad if you want, but I just like the confines of the tune to put an idea across. And then I also like the album as well, as like a thing that's been going for, I like the history of it, you know, like it's just been, the album's been going for however many times. It's like, you know, we're humans, we're like, you know, we're just like apes who've evolved. And for some reason, a 3 or 4 minute, like, piece of music with some singing on it is like, works for us. It's like, you know what I mean? That's the thing that works. That's why we've like based all these charts around it and stuff, because for some reason that there's a magic to that formula.
Yeah.
So... I don't know, yeah, from the uni thing, it was just the essay writing and the thinking about, like, higher level stuff than I came across before.
So most degrees, you look to try and create someone who's a critical thinker, and all your songs are critical thinking, like, they're all, like, they're challenging pre-existing ideas, That's yeah. And that's exact anyone who does well at university, that's they would have shown that in their final essays, their final reports, is that you challenge pre-existing ideas and critically yeah. think and critically analyse. And it's everything that's in your songs, I think, in many ways. So it's an interesting comparison to make. Your kind of finest moment for me, and probably the song you're most well known for, is Poem. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, indulge us, tell us all about writing that song and where that came from and the recording process from start to end.
Okay. I wrote it as like a poem.
So it was a poem?
Yeah, it was a poem, yeah.
Oh, that makes sense.
That's why it was called a poem, yeah. I read an article about homeless people being moved off the streets of London because they were like an eyesore for tourists. Hmm. So like that kind of just I was just like, wow, that is just like so backwards, like where are we, like what are we doing? And then I just wrote this big poem, and it just ended up like starting off with that focus of homelessness and you know that article, and then it just like I just kept on making the lens go a bit bigger really, and just bringing it out and kind of seeing how messed up everything is, but just on a bigger scale and what other factors were involved, and I think I see it as like a bit of a widening of the lens as the tune goes on, as the poem goes on. And I started off, I performed it as a poem, as a spoken word piece.
Did you?
A couple of times, yeah.
What, like open mics and stuff? Or
just like... that, like I had a couple of gigs, that then I was just starting to get gigs.
Right.
So I did it at Threshold Festival, and I did it at... Dave Monks did a night at the Cavern, in the back room of the Cavern.
All right.
And because I did a live radio session, which actually ended up being the thing that introduced me to Skeleton Key.
Ah.
I did like the Merseyside, BBC Radio Merseyside live thing, and then someone passed on the recording to James, and that's how I ended up getting involved with them.
So when you did it spoken word, was it... quite similar to
it was
how
just,
it is
it
now.
It was like literally just spoken word. It was just like okay. It was just like me saying it, no music or nothing. Because I was just at the time I didn't have a band or anything. It was just me playing. So it was just me playing tunes, and then I'd just like stop and did this poem, and then I was just thinking I should change it into a tune because I can write songs and I can. It seems to be like spoken words powerful, but if I can like put that into music, then it'll kind of make it more powerful. So that's what I did. So it's just like worked on a chorus, found the chorus, and then had to like chop and change it a little bit, but made it into a tune.
And how long until they build a wall and call it a private city? They got walls made out of laws to exclude you and me, and now they take away our right to fight those laws for free. No legal aid, no more justice, only for the wealthy. Oh, but they're trying to build a more healthy society, so that everybody...
Absolute work of art. It's a very, very beautiful piece of music. And now that you've kind of done some interesting stuff in the music industry... For young musicians listening, how does the music industry differ from your side of the fence now to before you were kind of in the music industry and your perception of what it was and what was involved?
That's good. I don't know, because it just seems like this. It's so big, the music industry, and it goes down so deep just to... I mean, I started off just doing open mic nights just on my own and... just like seeing if it could get anywhere, and just like the first thing is just like getting a set together, and I don't know what I expected really. I didn't really expect any like kind of massive jumps or anything, and it's not really been like that. Everything's been really gradual, which has been quite cool. But like it's just like there's always been something positive that keeps going forward, but at the same time it is like it's not like it's a breeze. It is also challenging to just be in the music industry. It's like there's always like a constant, well for me there's like quite a lot of emotional work like to get through, just to kind of to keep going in the music industry. But
What's the root of the emotional work that you have to do? What is the work?
I think, like, you've just got, personally, it's like, you've got, I've just got, like, a bit of a thing, like, you've got someone saying, you know, I just feel like if I'm going to be on the stage in front of all these people, what is the reason for me to be there? What's the deeper meaning? What's the purpose? Like, I kind of feel like the more further that I go on, I'm like, it's more important, like, to think about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it.
And what is the purpose?
I guess it is, like, what we were saying before, it's like, the purpose of the poet kind of thing is to ask those questions of the audience and to kind of, I feel, make people feel like they came and watched something that they wouldn't have seen anywhere else. But, I mean, you don't want to be like, on this person that just goes around and takes ticket money off people because I'm just doing this show and I'm just singing these songs because I feel like for me, I just need to make sure it's about something.
And the little thing you said there was really, really interesting about, you know, most new musicians who pick up an instrument, they actually just naturally want to be like the bands that they like. But I think you just said something there about people seeing something they won't see anywhere else.
Mm.
That's so key that you kind of, if you can kind of hone in on that and just go, this is what I offer, this is my thing, and it's no one else is doing that. That makes it so unique. Yeah. And so many people don't value that.
Yeah.
They always want to be like the band that they
like. I think that's the classic mistake, you know, like just from being around in rehearsal rooms and loads of places and things. It's like you do see a lot of people that are trying to do what's been done before.
Mm.
And if you can kind of just have your own thing, no matter what it is, even if it's like completely mad, then I think people prefer something that's completely like, wow, like that's a bit mad to something that they've seen before, you know what I mean?
What experience have you had in the last kind of couple of years since you've been, you know, this has really taken off for you? What experiences are the kind of ones that left you most buzzing afterwards? You were like, fuck yeah, that was amazing.
It is usually after a gig, like, yeah. If it's like a proper good gig.
How was the Glastonbury gig, by the way? I missed it.
Glastonbury is like right up there. It's probably, I mean, I just loved like winning the emerging talent was pretty like up there.
So did you won the emerging talent contest, was Michael Eavis someone who was judging? He was actual judge.
And Emily, yeah.
And Emily, right, judges, okay.
Yeah.
Shit. And so what, you just send in demos and they...
It's like a massive competition, so you have to send in either a video or a recording. And then that goes to like one set of judges and then that goes through to another. I think it's like the third round. I think like it goes through to like people that are all bloggers or writers or... you know, people that are in the music industry, and then they have loads to choose from and they pick their best ones.
And it gets filtered up all the way until
filtered up, and then it's like they have like 8 finalists, I think.
And you play live in front of them?
Yeah, play live in front of them, yeah, 2 tunes. Yeah,
what'd
so
you play?
I was like so nervous.
You remember what you played?
Poem and If You Could See.
Wow.
Yeah.
And was that before you'd recorded the album, or was the album already recorded? Can you remember?
We'd recorded the album. Right. Yeah, the album came out, I think the album came out like 2 days after we won it or something. Oh, I can't remember. Wow. It
was good,
like,
timing.
Yeah. It's like the album was all recorded. We just brought out Poem, I think.
Wow.
And then I went and it was just like a room, and it was like we had some friends and family there and stuff, and everyone did. It was like everyone was in different camps, and then it was like they were just like, the winner is, she drew the gun, and it was like, yeah, it was like, you know, your team winning like the cup final, but like you're the player as well.
Yeah. Oh, that must be magic. And those other 7 bands, did they go on to do anything? Can you remember any other 7 bands?
Like, yeah, I wonder how much going around. Yeah,
right, that's cool.
I remember a few. Yeah, there's like Bossy Love is one of them from Glasgow. Mm. And I still follow them on social media. And Hattie Whitehead was another one that was, I still see her like doing stuff, still follow them on social media. And
it makes a lot of sense that what you're doing would win something like that at Glastonbury. There's an alignment, I think, between what you sing about and what Michael Eavis wants to achieve, and I think that probably helps quite a lot.
I think that won it for us, really.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine he enjoyed poem especially. Yeah, I mean, going back to the kind of the music industry question, a question we ask everyone actually on the podcast is, what fears do you have for the music industry and how might those fears be addressed?
Yeah, I think the fear is that it becomes more homogenised, like just music in general. And then I think it's just hard for musicians at the bottom. There's not as much money as there was. So I think in all the arts as well, it's like there's not that much money floating around, and I think the danger is that you end up with only people that can afford to do it can do it, instead of it being more open to everyone being able to do it, because it's not just like the starting out, it's the carrying on getting to the next level. You know, you need a bit of investment and you need to spend time, and if you've got to, you know, do a full-time job as well, it's hard. And I think that's the fear, that it's just left to the rich kids. like gentrification of the arts is a thing. Like, I think, like, you know, a lot of old Liverpool bands wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for the Dole, like being at certain times being easy to get, and and, you know, certain schemes that would help musicians and things like that. And it just seems like now the government is harsher than ever on people being unemployed or people being in low paid jobs and things like that. It's just harder for people in general. So I don't know, sometimes that does make good art though. So there is always like a pushback against it. Like, I think a lot of good art is about resisting. But yeah, the music industry also, that that everything gets chosen by algorithms and stuff, and that you lose the diversity in it. But I'm not sure, because I think it'll be all right.
And just that, you know, regular listeners would have heard this stuff before, but people who aren't, you know, the last episode we had with Clive Dean from, he's now Radiohead's live drummer, and he's an original member of Portishead, and Jeff in Portishead shared his PRS statement where it showed that last year Portishead's record Dummy from the 90s had 34 million streams, and he earned $2,500 from it, which would be like if he lived in London, like a month's rent, do you know what I mean, or something like that. Yeah, so that kind of just shows you where the whole model just isn't working at the moment, unfortunately, I think, with all the streaming. So yeah, it must be loads of challenges for you, I'd imagine. Cool, but what's, I mean, let's look at the positive. I mean, going forward, you've just done a fucking blinding new album. You're going out on tour, is that right? Is it after Christmas you're going out on tour?
Yeah, February, March time, yeah.
All across the UK?
Yeah, the UK, yeah.
Good stuff. And where can people find out? SheDrewTheGun.com?
SheDrewTheGun.com, yeah. All the usual channels and social media things.
Good stuff. Yeah, and I just want to say, yeah, no, thanks so much for coming on the Stage Left podcast. Don't let the bastards get you down. Mate. Keep doing what you're great at. Keep singing on behalf of those caged birds. Keep raising awareness of the changes this world desperately needs. Keep writing such great tunes. Good luck with the upcoming tour, and we hope you enjoyed appearing on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you. It's been amazing. Cool.
So thank you so much to Larisa for an amazing weekend, an amazing interview, and for the record. You've got to check out the record. Just so many good tunes on there. Such a future Louisa has, I think. You know, you got to check out her stuff. So if you'd like to have dinner with Louisa even, you can and see her play to just seven people in our lounge in Vauxhall with a five-course meal cooked by the award-winning chef at the Villa Juaza Pavacuta. You can email stageleftnights@gmail.com to secure yourself one of the rare seven tickets. You can follow us on Twitter at the Stage Left Pod. That'd be really good. Spread the word of the podcast and why we exist. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/StageLeftPodcast or on our Instagram page. You can follow us as well at the Stage Left Podcast or Stage Left Nights. So for the specific kind of dinner and live gig, live events thing, we have a separate handle, which is at Stage Left Nights. Okay, thank you so much. The next episode is going to be with Ian Brodie of the Lightning Seeds.